Shervin Malekzadeh, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Talking about education in Iran, particularly primary education, secondary education, higher education, is something we haven't really covered before. So tell us a little bit about your work and how you became involved in studying education in Iran.
Well, I mean, my involvement, the study of schooling in Iran, begins with me being in a first grade classroom in California and then later in D.C. and born in Iran, but raised in the U.S. since 10 months old. And I'm standing before a class of mostly, I mean, in the case of California, all Latino kids, many of whom are just learning English or their parents don't speak any English at all. So, you know, part of my task is to teach them literacy, obviously. This is a public school, a charter school, but also to make them American citizens. You know, I'm old enough, Gen X guy, to have bridged the sort of traditional narrative, what it means to be American, the sort of stories that we learned growing up, and I think these are very important, these sort of myths, if you want to call them, or if you want to be more cynical, lies that sort of holds a society together. But on the other hand, you know, I've been exposed in college and beyond in terms of revisionist history, who was Columbus, right, and the, sort of the awfulness around his story. So bottom line is, how do I teach six-year-olds about Columbus coming over to the Americas? And I ended up sort of negotiating between the sort of traditional story, you know, we're all Americans, this is what holds us together, and giving them quote-unquote accurate information, quote-unquote, because I didn't go that much into detail into the sort of politics of it. But yeah, so it got me thinking, well, this is in the U.S., and the stakes are relatively low. What's it like in Iran when you have to teach about a revolution? And let's say you were born and raised under the Shah's regime, and now you're under a very different regime, and you manage to keep your job as a first grade teacher. And I have family in Iran who've had this similar scenario. What happens when you have to negotiate between the state, which gives you a curriculum, and the community that you're serving? And I think teachers really have two bosses, right? You know, you have the administration or the sort of state entity, but you have the families who have certain expectations about what they want for their children. So that story for me was very fascinating. And, you know, it gave me an excuse to get money to go back to Iran and hang out with my family and be fed well. So that's the less impressive part of the answer. But yeah, and I ended up hanging out with a lot of Mexicanists, historians who worked on Mexican Revolution. You have a very similar story in Mexico in the early 20th century. So that intellectual framework I then applied to the case of Iran. And it's rarely talked about, which is shocking to me. We think of schooling either as a place where kids go to be brainwashed, to be shaped like putty. And it's surprising to me that people think that. If you've stood in front of 6 or 7 year olds, you know that they have a lot of power, right? But then, at least in the case of Iran, that all changes once the students, especially female students, enter university. Then it's assumed that they become rebels, right? They turn against the state or the system. They're no longer brainwashed. And so trying to reconcile those two sort of conflicting stories has been a lot of my work, I think.
Well, we're going to get to this notion of girls in education in a minute, because your work on that's really interesting. But going back to some of the things that when you're comparing kind of like what's going on here in your experience in the U.S. and then, of course, going back to Iran and studying education there, that you found some similarities. I mean, one of the things you've talked about in your work is education in Iran, the debate about whether it's a public good or yeah, a private resource. And we clearly are facing that in the United States. States as well, and in terms of decreased public funding for education, higher education, common education, and you know, passing the burden, if you will, of that support onto families and individuals.
Right.
So, did you find some similarities there, and how do the Iranians come down on that in terms of public good versus private resource?
Absolutely. So, this is a really important point that you're raising, and this is where, you know, I think a lot of us working on Iran are really keen on making Iran ordinary, rather than the sort of extraordinary place, a scary place, if you will. And I think the angle on schooling that you just described is a great way of doing that, because, you know, the story of education worldwide, modern education, I think, is what was previously a private enterprise, right? People who could afford it or who were blessed enough or smart enough to have access to education in the 18th or 19th or 17th centuries. You know, by the time we get to the end of 19th or early 20th centuries, again, globally, it starts to become the sort of public enterprise, right? We need to make a nation, a state. We need everybody educated, women as well, mothers as well, so that we can prosper as countries. And this is precisely the story of Iran, of course, influenced by the Europeans and then later the Americans. So the project of schooling in Iran, once it becomes a sort of public enterprise, you see a very consistent pattern where the state is trying to get folks to be loyal to the state, to the whatever regime's in charge, as well as skilled, right? So identifying talents and preserving loyalty, I think, is very similar across all societies in terms of the function of schooling. It has a sort of conservative element as well as a very progressive or innovative element in terms of what we teach kids. And what you see in Iran, I think, over 100 years almost at this point, is a consistent pattern where families send their students, their children to school so that they can have good lives. And I think this is very often forgotten. I mean, we take this for granted when we talk about the U.S. context or European context, but when we talk about openly ideological states like Iran, the former Soviet Union, Cuba, we just assume students go there to be brainwashed, or having failed to brainwash or inculcate ideas, to put it more nicely, the students become rebellious, right, dissidents, et cetera. No, families send their kids to school so they can get a good job and get married. I think the evidence is clear, and you interview Iranians, you see this pretty consistently. So I've written a lot about the sort of commodification of schooling and education in Iran, the transformation of what is a state resource back into a private. We've come full circle. Schooling was private. For only the select few, it becomes a sort of mass enterprise. And once again, we see it going back private in that, as in the U.S., I think, parents send their students and they're willing to spend tons of money, right? It's a $3 billion industry at this point in Iran. And I think 80-85% of the universities are fee-based, even the state sector ones. And we see a very similar pattern here in the U.S. because the point is, I got to get that paper. You know, this is the peril of the meritocracy, right? I got to get that paper so that my young son or young daughter is established and then can go out into the marriage market, labor market. And in fact, it's a sort of escalating arms race. It's now, in Iran at least, just as here, the bachelor's is no longer sufficient. Now you have to get a master's, right? Then you have to get a PhD, et cetera, or go overseas and study in the case of the Iranian student. So I see incredible similarities. I think it's based on a similar logic of what the purpose of modern schooling is and the sort of relationship it has with specifically the labor market, but I think also marriage market very often. You know, I don't want my daughter to marry an ill-educated guy, whatever that means, right? We have this sort of notion that you're a good person if you've been to university, I guess.
Well, this is an interesting narrative, and it really resonates with me as an educator, as somebody who works in higher education, has spent my entire adult life in higher education as a student and then as a professor. But, obviously higher education in the United States, and to me personally, was a very important way in which I was able to improve my life. And this is, clearly what we do in the United States. It's becoming more and more difficult because of that private requirement rather than the public resource. But I want to get to your work on women in particular, as you're talking about marriage and marriage prospects. You want your daughter to marry somebody who's educated, so therefore she must be educated. But you've also talked about how participation and education, I would presume, makes you a modern girl, right? And so what is it that you mean by that? And how does girls' education fit into this picture?
That title is a ripoff of Carrie Brownstein's book, Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl. And this is me being playful with the talk, but really what I'm – the inscription of modernity, the notion that women's role in society, their sort of external features, as well as what they do as in terms of their citizenship in Iran, is, I think, has become the standard benchmark for where Iran stands in terms of what we think of modernity. Of course, that's a big word, right? And we have many notions of what that means. But it's often measured or benchmarked through the participation or lack of participation of women. It's assumed that if women are becoming modern in Iran, it's in spite of the system, that this is a system that denies modernity to all citizens, but specifically women. And my claim today, and this is a provocative claim, but I think it's perhaps there's empirical evidence for this, that it's through this very system that allows women to achieve certain gains that the advancement of individual agency, the capacity to make individual choices, to participate in society in a more full manner, I think is through this seemingly agency-denying system. And it's premised on the idea, the logic of the Islamic Republic of needing to demonstrate that it is the path to democracy, the path to a modern or progressive outcome, which sounds weird to our American ears perhaps, right? But within the regime sort of thinking, the state's thinking, this is very much its principle, one of its founding. And this could be cynical, right? Maybe they don't believe any of this, but it's out there. And so therefore, if you're going to have a society, particularly a society that's segregated by gender, you can't have a scenario where women aren't physicians, where women aren't attorneys or participating in the public sector or even the private sector. So what I, you know, the rates of participation for women, and this is where we can again draw parallels to the U.S., are just, they blow the guy, the boys away. As we see here in the States, I'm sure you see here at OU, I've seen at the elementary level when I taught, at the university level, women do very well in education, schooling, in terms of participation, enthusiasm, and testing, et cetera, however you want to measure it. And it's the boys in many ways who are being left behind. So this is has been really a big story in Iran in terms of women's success. Overall, they're 50% of the student population, but at the elite schools, they're well over 50%, approaching, I think, 60, maybe even more than 60%. So the top students in Iran are women. Now, sorry, this is long-winded, but the contradiction here is that the greatest indicator of unemployment is to be a young, educated female in Iran.
Well, so this is what I was going to ask.
So that raises a very interesting question, doesn't it?
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And this is the whole point. I mean, I see exactly what you're saying. I've experienced exactly what you're saying.
Right.
But the question is the opportunity post-education, right? Or as one's education continues post-graduation or whatever it is, as you're moving through life, then, you know, do you see in Iran, like we often see in the United States, that that then women tend to drop off or drop out or, you know, end up, that pipeline becomes, you know, smaller and smaller as we move up through, whether it's, you know, the ranks in the corporate world or in higher education or wherever you may be. I mean, the opportunity that exists afterwards is really in question, is it not?
I think for me personally, the focus on economic outcomes maybe was too narrow a focus for me. To answer your question directly, no, they don't drop out. They double down. We had bottlenecks in Iran at the university, the bachelor's level. Acceptance rates historically in Iran have been about 10%, 13%, 15%. Now it's basically 100%. Still at the elite schools, what would be considered elite in Iran, University of Tehran, for example, it's still about 10% acceptance rate. So going to university is no longer, it's now normal. But the doubling down, by that I mean master's, PhD, there the bottleneck is very much in effect, 5%, 6%. And what we see are women and men, but mostly women still pursuing that advanced degree. So they're not giving up despite these sort of economic outcomes that we've been talking about. And I'm not sure why. I assume it's because of the sort of sociology of the situation in Iran, that to be a full human, insan-e kamel, right, in Farsi, to be a good person, you do need to have this sort of education. But if you can't get a job, then why bother? And anecdotally, what you'll hear when you're in Iran is that this is to keep women busy until they get married and settle down and become a mom or whatever. This is all sort of performance. I doubt that young women think that way when they're, you know, sitting down for that the high stakes entrance exam for the PhD or whatever they're pursuing. So.
Have you explored that, though? Do you know what perhaps women are thinking about that? Then maybe that's the next
phase. That's a tough question, yeah, and I appreciate you asking. I really, it's clear that the economic explanation is not sufficient, right? Because it doesn't logically make sense why. I think we could ask the same question here in the States, though, right? Just to be a little mischievous about my answer. I do think that worldwide, but especially in Iran, it's become normal, quote-unquote, to be educated, and that definition is expanded increasingly for women from a sixth grade education to a high school diploma to a university, et cetera. And so what I think is really exciting, the poli-sci part of it for me, is how women appropriating that. There's a scholar, Najma Abadi, who's written about crafting an educated housewife. Originally, women were educated to be good housewives, to stay at home. But they took advantage of that logic, the state, this is early 20th century, to become more educated. You want to have a good citizen or citizenry? Well, then I need to have a high school diploma. Well, I need a university diploma, right? So you keep moving that bar up. And I think the logic of the Islamic Republic also facilitates the rise of women in terms of educational standards and measurements. But why do they persist if they're not getting a job or if they're not able to get married right away? That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that yet. So.
Well, I imagine I'll look forward to having you back because
okay,
I think this is very interesting information about women in Iran and their educational levels and just education in general in Iran, some interesting comparisons. But I think it'll be interesting to hear what women are thinking as they're moving through the system because we're asking more and more often what women in the U.S. are thinking, for example, about their opportunities going forward. Well, Shervin, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Yeah,
it's been a pleasure meeting you and having you share your research with us. Thank you.